We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Duup and Mason Ginsberg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time. Welcome to another special episode of In the Know, bonus content that we're trying to deliver on a semi-regular basis, maybe every other week or so. We are joined by a special guest, someone that you guys perhaps thought disappeared forever until he popped up recently and wrote an article on trades. We are joined, Mason and I are joined by Michael McNamara. Mike, what is up with you, man? Where have you been?
Business got away from Pelicans for a little bit. Had a pretty crazy couple of months. Just sold one of my companies, so now I got some time to kind of harass people and think and talk Pelicans again.
Yeah, well, you've been harassing us in the group chat, so I'll leave it at that.
But yeah, it's good. Mason's team can't go out and sign the most expensive picture in baseball of telling me that they're building the right way and these aren't the old Yankees and then get me.
The lovable Yankees of young players was fun while it lasted, and then they just got fed up with not having any good starting pitching.
I don't know anything about baseball, but I am seeing all these takes about how every team had this opportunity to spend money, and it's these cheap billionaires who don't want to spend money to win. And is that really the case, or is it just a case of Yankees are our destination, and then they'll pay whatever it takes?
This is going to quickly devolve into a Lakers conversation, so I'm gonna pause there. But the Yankees have an semi unfair advantage that. But it seems like the Dodgers, I think, would have similar advantages. So,
yeah, well, I'll admit it. At least Anthony Davis is doing well on the Lakers. We're so happy about that, guys. anywho, let's get this show on the road. Now, I'm told that we had certain takes that we made last podcast, not necessarily basketball related, that Mike wanted to address. Something to do with some arms and legs. Mike, what do you got there?
Yeah, first of all, I want to say I think you guys are doing awesome. I actually listened to the most recent pod twice. Now, that was mostly for the Roman commercial. That guy's is so incredibly soothing.
Tyler's going to love that so much. I can't wait to talk to him about it.
Don't need the product yet, but I have been to the website just because of that guy. No, my first one is actually semi-serious. When you guys were talking about coaches, and I do this myself, should we move Bud into that needle moving category? Because I look at like resumes like him and Stevens, and I say, what's the difference? And is Bud's resume possibly even better? I know he gets stung for not having the playoff success, but if you want to talk about a coach that moves the needle, at least in the regular season, how come Bud's name doesn't come up in your guys' mind?
That's a good question.
The first thought I had was that because of who he replaced, Jason Kidd, right? And it's a similar argument for Steve Kerr and Mark Jackson. But I don't think that's a fair question.
My
in Atlanta and yeah,
my take comes from the playoff, and it's not that he hasn't made it to certain rounds in the playoffs. It's the fashion that he's lost in the playoffs, and I think the past three of his playoff exits have been sweeps, and or not necessarily sweeps, but they've lost four in a row, and so he might very well raise the bar in the regular season. I do think it's fair to question if he's and his staff are able to make the adjustments needed on a game by game or even like a half by half basis in the playoffs, where everything is so scrutinized and everything is so drilled down. Because when you drop four in a row, I think that it has to do more than just talent disparity, because especially last year's Bucks, they had the talent, and losing four in a row to the Raptors, I think, shows that an inability to adjust properly to the counter adjustment the opponent made.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I even watched the Milwaukee-Toronto game, game six the other day. I still have no clue how Milwaukee lost that game. But I mean, I'm looking at Stevens specifically, and I mean, the only real playoff success he had was that year where the East was absolutely decimated. Like, you take last year's Bucks and put them in the East 2 years ago, and they fly through that East too and demolish King James and the Cavs. I mean, I just think a lot of it is circumstance, but he's just a guy I think that I would put in the moving the needle, but bigger to your point, you guys are right. There aren't many of those. So on to the more important issue, forearm or leg. So I think there was a couple of things that were just brushed over and also given too much credit. So Shamit, one of the things you did, for instance, you're like, imagine if I had four arms, I would be able to scroll on my phone and type and, you know, doing all this stuff. You don't have two brains and four eyes also. Like, you're still extremely limited. You just because you have four hands to hold things doesn't mean you would be able to both type a coherent paragraph and scroll on your phone and look at the Instagram girls that we know you tend to. So I don't think the arms have the advantage.
What? Okay, well, what's your argument for legs?
My biggest argument for legs is clothing. So I think we have to go with the assumption that if you have four legs, that doesn't mean you also have an additional buttocks and front member. So I don't think you have to wear any clothes on that other pair of legs, where I think the four arms is absolutely a nightmare for clothing. So
wear a tank top, like a massive tank top.
And how are we not talking about sponsorships here? If you're the freak with four arms or four legs, you're getting all your clothes paid for.
Yeah, I think it looks better. I think most people greet and look each other from the waist up, and that's where you're going to spend most of your attention. And I think either of those abnormalities are just going to be hideous. I'd rather have them on the legs. Speed, I think you guys underplayed a little bit.
How often do you use speed in your day-to-day basis?
I mean, I guess this is the question, is like, are we getting these four legs at birth? or are we getting them now in our 30s into that? But if I get it from birth, like, to me, that advantage is instantaneous, and it's impossible to overcome when you look at athletics.
Would you be banned from competing, though?
Yeah, no, this has always been the most interesting thing to me is whenever I see an X-Men or a Mutants movie, I wonder, okay, one of those is going to play sports, and it's the Super Bowl. There's 5 seconds left, and they hand it off to the guy, and he decides to use his powers for the first time and just fly over everybody for the touchdown. Like, that would be the biggest story in SportsCenter history, and the debates on Twitter about whether that should be allowed, whether he or she should be allowed to play. Like, to me, that is the next evolution of sports that I'm, yeah, as kids would say, here for.
I agree.
We talked about that a lot, in the sense that I think it's more real and more coming than I think we like to give credit to, because you think about someone like, you know, you go overseas and you're deployed, you lose a limb, and it gets replaced by some sort of bionic limb, and you're going to tell that person they can't play professional sports. Like, what's the, where's the line? I think it's really interesting.
Well, it was the whole debate with Oscar Pistorius before he like murder suicided his wife. And I guess, no, he didn't kill himself. He killed the wife and the lover. I don't know. He killed like a couple people, but yeah, I don't think that's the relevant part.
I think it's RoboCop versus Vader. If you are showing your chin, you could compete. But if you're fully covered in the robot, you do whatever, you can't.
I'll take it.
Okay.
That's a fair balance.
No, I just think that it was a little bit more of a debate. But again, we need clarification from the person on if you're getting this at birth or we're just getting it now, which also might cause whole new issues in my marriage if it's right now.
But I feel like we also focused pretty heavily on the sports aspect. You know, Schmidt focused on ultimate. I focused on baseball and having two extra arms to pitch. And I feel like we hit the sports aspect pretty hard. But yeah, I maybe we did underplay the speed aspect.
All right, and then my last one. Getting back to serious and to kind of discuss this articles. I've seen a little bit on Twitter, and then you guys also in the last pod talking about maybe the selfishness of these players and how Griffin in front office might have underestimated that or just misjudged their character. I have a slightly different take, and it's kind of semantics, but I don't really see these guys as selfish as much as I see them of lack of trusting of each other. So like, to me, Marcus Thornton, no matter what time the game is, no matter what the score is, he's going to be selfish and be out there for him. What I've seen from these Pelicans players is they start off the right way, and then another team goes on an 8-0 run, and it's, okay, I'm going to do this myself because I don't trust the other guys. And like, you even saw it last night, and it had some positive results, but I think, you know, the game was starting to get away. I think Philly was up like 7 or 9 with about 3 minutes left. And the next two possessions involved no passes. The first one was Ingram coming right up the court and shooting a mid-range jumper that he hit. And the next one was Drew doing almost the exact same thing from three. I think there is a difference between being selfish and being out for your own, and then when things going bad, having no faith and trust in your teammates, so you think you're the best person to be able to stop the skid or to turn things back around, so you just go out for your own. Do you guys agree with that? Disagree? Do you even think there's a difference between those two things?
I agree there's a difference. I do think that there are other external factors that these players are playing for in terms of maybe a future contract or trying to prove a point about playing time. Those kind of things, I think, are a little bit difficult to analyze for us because we don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes. But my gut tells me some of those factors are playing in when it comes to, perhaps, as you say, their decision to kind of abandon the system and take it upon their own shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, so there's two different ways to look at that. One is, I think, Mac, I think you're right in the sense that if there's the other team's going on a run, some of the players on the Pelicans just think it's on them because they don't trust others to stop it. But there are other situations. I can't remember which game, which loss it was. They're all blending in at this point, but this comment may explain a few different games, but that third quarter, a few games back where they just chucked like 15 threes. And yes, this is pretty much every game at this point, but that's, you know, I think about that, and I don't think there was any sort of let's stop the run. I mean, the situation is kind of correlated because the lead for the opponent kept getting bigger and bigger because they were playing this way. But I feel like there was a certain, I don't know if that was just let's stop the bleeding as much as it's I'm going to go get mine. So I think there's some of both.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. It's for me, it's getting hard for this season to parse, because I think there have been far more games like the Philly game, the Philly loss last night, than there have been the terrible Dallas loss or, you know, the first half against Milwaukee. And it just seems like it's hard, like it's almost two different teams, like the close loss teams. And then I think these crazy games are just an aberration. And to me, when the games are close, for the most part, they're playing the right type of basketball, and I don't see a ton of selfishness. But then when things start getting away, it's, yeah, you're right, it's a little bit of both. But I don't see Marcus Thornton's on this team. I think Josh Hart thinks he's way better than he actually is, and him taking those shots is not him trying to get money in 2 years as much as, man, these guys suck, let's let Josh Hart do his thing to get this team a win. So,
okay, fair enough. So, given what we said in our last pod, and we kind of danced around the different roster issues and trade issues, you wrote an article that where you laid out how you would approach the Pelicans going into the deadline, not what you think Griff should do or what you're predicting he's going to do, but what you would do if you were in his seat. And you broke it down into guys you'd be aggressive in seeking out offers, guys you would, you know, listen to offers, and, you know, I guess other guys you're ambivalent-ish about, like where it doesn't really move the needle if they're moved or not. So do you want to touch on that article and kind of the points you want to talk about here with us?
No, I wanted to talk about forums for a late. Okay, I'll talk about that. So the first thing you have to understand is every article I've ever written comes from me seeing somebody say something on the internet I think is stupid and trying to give more depth to that. So, you know, what got me back was I see very simple questions like, should we trade Drew? Should we trade JJ? It's not that simple. Everything has a cost. Everything, you know, almost any player would be moved depending on what they could get, the circumstances, whatever. What it really is how aggressive you are in moving that person, versus your willingness to allow somebody to come in and overpay market value for them. Like, my house isn't for sale right now, but if somebody came in and gave me 150% cash to close in 21 days, my house would be sold. So anyway, that's where it stemmed from and what I kind of wanted to talk about in the article. And to me, Lonzo is just the number one you have to move on from sooner rather than later. And it's just because, you know, when I studied businesses as I went into kind of starting my own businesses, what you see over and over again is the ones that fail are just thinking 3 and 4 years out, and they're talking about why they're going to succeed. The businesses that actually do the best are the ones that go, okay, 3 years from now, we've failed, we're going out of business, why? And then they spend time on that and work backwards to prevent that, you know, from happening. And when I look at Lonzo and I say, okay, 2-3 summers from now, where is he going to be with this roster? All of the outcomes that are realistic to me involve him either being gone or him being here but overpaid, and or the team still committing to resources because of this potential that comes from his pedigree. Like, I look at him as if he was the 27th pick of a draft, and you wouldn't be continuously trying to talk yourself into that player. And I just see far more dangers with him having the good game every once in a while. I think he had one two or three nights ago. And you talking yourself into, okay, this is going to work. All we got to do is improve this, this, and this. And you keep pumping resources into him. It comes time for the contract. Another team believes in him, so they overpay him, and you match because you don't want to, quote unquote, lose him for free. And I just see far more dangers in going down that road than, you know, cutting bait with him right now, finding somebody that'll help you for, as a veteran presence for the next 2 or 3 years and maybe a future asset, and then pouring that same resource and hope into other players like Nikhil Alexander Walker or whoever your next rookie is going to be. Like, how upset would you be if the Pelicans didn't draft a point guard in the next draft? He was clearly the best player on the board, but they don't take him because Lonzo shows some flashes at the end of this year and instead go for another position. Like, that's a realistic possibility as long as the number two pick with pedigree is on your roster. If he has a great February, March, and April, you're in real danger of talking yourself into stuff and doing that. I just see far more problems with Lonzo being on the team than just cutting bait right now.
So you were advocating to be aggressive as soon as the deadline, like approaching the deadline. Now, be aggressive now. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I would get a gauge for the teams that believe in him. And yes, I would be aggressive with basically, I am moving him by February 6th. The only way I don't is if I'm offered more toxic things in return. And only that.
So I have a little bit of pushback. And while I think I agree with your overall assessment of the pitfalls of buying into his potential, and I've been a believer that, you know, if a player can't succeed in a bad situation, that tells you a lot about them as well. But I do think there's merit to waiting until Zion gets back, only because if Lonzo is better when other people fall in their more natural roles, and perhaps Zion makes the game easier for him from a transition and passing standpoint, if he is better, then maybe you can find a team that was on the fence and then believes in him. And it opens up your possibility for finding trade partners and perhaps increases his value a bit. And so I think they should definitely have a hard date where they want to have a decision point. And I think that date should come before draft night. And that doesn't mean a deal should happen before draft night. I think they should have a decision point where they're like, okay, what are we going to do with him? And going into the draft, they should know exactly what their future is with Lonzo. And if they've made up their mind to trade him, if they find a deal at draft night, great. If they don't find a deal at draft night, be aggressive in the summer. That's the only adjustment I would make.
Yeah, I think the draft comment may be overstated a little bit. I think in the NBA, we've gotten to the point where teams are drafting best player available in most cases. That doesn't hold true for everyone, but in most cases, you're just taking the best player available, I think. So I wouldn't be concerned about the draft picking somebody just because you think Lonzo may have figured it out. That said, I do think the financial risk to this team is very real if you can talk yourself into it. I align with what Schmidt's saying in the sense that if you can do anything to – because his value right now, obviously to the Pelicans is low, but I also think around the league after, you know, they're paying attention to, and I think his value is low. So if you think the situation is going to get better, and between the Zion returning and also this team playing some bad teams over the next month or so, I don't think you're going to swindle anyone into some false sense of how good he is just because they played a few shitty teams. But I do think it's worth kind of extending the runway a little bit just to give him that, that opportunity, because he's had, to your point at the start, maybe one or two games that have been not bad. And so I think I would give it a little bit more time.
Yeah, I mean, I had made that exact same argument that you guys made with Eric Gordon back in the day, or at least heard other people make that. And it's like you have this distressed asset and you say, well, then let's wait till it's less distressed or not distressed in movement and move it. And what actually ends up happening is the guy plays pretty well and the team seems to work well around it. And then you go, okay, so then why are we going to trade him? Or your perception of him goes up more than his incremental trade value gets up. And it's just, it's almost impossible to ever find that equilibrium where it's like, okay, he raised his value enough around the league to also be higher than his value is to me right now. And I think trying to play that game, yes, is optimal, but more times than not, it'll just lead to the kicking the can further and further and further down the road, and you'll buy in and then they'll get hurt again or whatever. To me, once you have something like that, just cut bait. So I guess it's all a matter of what we're talking about here. So I posed a couple of pretty specific trades that I would take in the article, and I'm curious if you would take those on December 15th. So like one was, I believe, Lonzo Ball and either Etuan Moore or Darius Miller, and you just get Patty Mills and Damari Carroll, who both have additional years on their contract to come in, be role-playing vets. So that, would that be enough for you, or would you continue looking around the league for deals if that was your only offer and nobody else was really wanting to trade with you at this time?
I would wait on that one. And it's not a deal where I would curse the Pelicans for doing it, but it's also a situation where I think I'm also willing to wait on I think the concept of Lonzo playing better and also tricking the Pelicans into thinking he can be better for them is fair. But I also wonder what it depends on what areas he improves in, for example. So if his 3-point percentage ticks up by 5%, I'm still sending him out any chance I can. Whereas if he legitimately looks like he's kind of figuring it out in terms of driving and attacking the rim, I'd want to see it over a reasonable sample, but I'd be more inclined to buy in than if it was just like he started randomly shooting better. I don't think that's enough for me, at least without any draft capital right now.
For me, I would do the trade mostly because I'm out on Lonzo for many of the same reasons Max talked about. Even though I would like for them to try to pump his value up a little bit, I don't have any hopes of that actually playing out long term. Realistically, I don't think it's going to happen. Now, the idea with Damari Carroll and Patty Mills is that you want them around for the next year as well, right? To sort of help the other young players learn, you know, do the whole JJ in favors thing where you want to help the young players learn what it is to take, what it takes to be a pro, but also they give you guys who can contribute night in and night out, and you know what you're going to get from them. There's no mystery of like, oh, well, is Lonzo going to give us a 20-10 night? Or is he going to give us a 2-for-12, 6 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 assists and 3 turnovers?
Yeah, exactly. Not only that, but it also allows me to concentrate my resources and development on other young guys I might believe in more, like Nickeil Alexander-Walker, for instance, or next year, whoever our rookie is, which I would bet highly on it being a guard versus Lonzo. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And I think the big thing is somebody looks at a 22-year-old like Lonzo, and the reason they're so appealing is because you think, oh, what could they be in 4, 5, 6 years? To me, in this trade, if I'm just looking at it, I never look at a trade as me trading this guy for that guy. I always look at it as I have none of these guys on my roster. Now, given that, which ones would I pick? And to me, Lonzo Ball, Patty Mills, Damari Carroll, none of those guys will be on my team in 3 years. So I'm asking myself, who is better over the next two and a half years for what I want to accomplish? And when you look at it that way and try to get away from potential and ceiling and all that stuff, to me, it's clear that Patty Mills and Damari Carroll would bring more on-court value and way more off-court value than Ball will over the next 2 or 3 years. And I make Gentry or whoever the next coach is, decision is very simple as far as who to give my backup guard minutes to. I mean, Alexander Walker actually came off the bench last night before Lonzo, but you feel like you've got to give Lonzo those minutes, and that's going to continue down the line where in February, when the Pelicans are clearly out of the playoffs, you don't feel like you have to give Patty Mills minutes, and now you could give them all to Nikhil Alexander Walker if it really is developmental time, and you know Patty Mills could nurse his knee or whatever after a tough Olympic season, and you know whatever. So that's the full idea.
Yeah, I kind of the trades you mentioned, I think I'd much rather pull the trigger on a Satoransky just one for one swap, and I think the Bulls you could kind of trick the Bulls into something like that too. So I probably would do that one.
Yeah, that would be fine for me. To me, the dream is the Covington one where I package all the guys together and get Covington and take on Deng's contract, which yeah, brings me to the next one I would be aggressive on, and that's the Moore and Miller expiring contracts. I think what Griffin did was smart in thinking that he might be a buyer this year, and I still think that if Zion didn't get the surgery, the Pelicans would be in seventh right now in the playoff hunt, and there would be a legitimate thought of being buyers. But basically, all Miller and Moore were going into the season were expiring contracts to make trades work, and I think you could kick the can forward on them while picking up an asset. So that would be the other calls I would be making. I would say, hey, I got two expirings here. Give me your bad 2-year contract and throw a little sweetener my way. And hey, now Minnesota, you guys could be players in this market. When I know your time clock is clicking on Towns, here's a get out of free jail card on the Jang contract. Just throw me a couple sweeteners here or there. And now I have a trade trip for next year when I'm hopefully good.
You know who has some bad 2-year contracts or in a lot of 2-year contracts? The Knicks. That's all they did. They signed a bunch of 2-year deals. I mean, yeah, if you could get Taj Gibson out of it, for sure.
I don't think the Knicks work because basically you would have to find a team that wants to be aggressive next summer. And I don't think the Knicks are even delusional enough to think that next summer is something that would bring any true value to their team. To me, Minnesota's the one because they're on a time clock, and I think that they think that that next summer they're never going to be somebody that gets a Giannis, so next summer's free agent pool lines up better for them. But yeah, there's a couple. The Heat have some really bad 2-year contracts. There's a couple out there.
Okay. Yeah, no, I agree with that philosophy. I mean, I don't think Moore and Miller were going to net us much anyway in terms of buying because there just aren't that many bad contracts left. I mean, I think the worst contract left right now is, what, Nick Batum?
That's another good one, yeah.
Yeah, and so I agree. If you could kind of package them together, consolidate your salary, open up a roster spot, which I think is underlooked. I genuinely think if they had an opportunity to bring in Didi at the end of the year, they're going to take it. And I think part of that is they don't want him to be a flight risk to Europe where he might sign a deal that's harder to get out of, or they end up having to pay more to get him out of. If they can open up a roster spot, secure him on a rookie scale minimum deal, maybe even, you know, like the Superman, it's slightly above the minimum. And if that means eating into 1 year of his eligibility, they'll take it, versus them kind of waiting around and him hopping off to a European team and them dealing with all that. So I think I would do it just for that reason, just to open up that roster spot. And even if it doesn't mean bringing in Didi, like bringing in someone else, just to open up that roster spot.
Yeah. And I think there's another reason you do something like that. And it relates to the free agent class in 2 years. And so if you do that and you make a deal for, say, like a guy like Nick Batum, who's expiring next year on a huge deal, you could also in turn flip that next summer. And I think this is kind of what Mac was getting at. You flip it next summer for a guy who may be undervalued because the team just wants to create cap space for that big free agent summer. And if you don't think in 2 years New Orleans is going to be a player for any of these big names, and I think maybe it's a little too soon for something like that, unless Zion really does bring a name that quickly. I think it's something where you could take a look at anyone who has whose contract extends past that year, and they may be significantly undervalued just because the team wants to free up cap space.
Yeah, I think that Griffin should and will be aggressive in doing that. I mean, the alternative is you do have Miller. You have an option on Miller, so you could bring him back next year and do the same exact thing.
It's just wild, though, right? Darius Miller.
That would be crazy. And then you would also have to spend cap space to go sign a guy to a one-year deal. And I think that gets a little trickier. So, and I don't think you're not going to have the availability if you have cap space to do like an Iguodala deal next year where some team dumps a player onto you and gives you a pick because there's no free agents that they're chasing. And also there'll be enough other teams with cap space. So like, if you're really looking at it that way, I think the best chance to get an asset and then also roll over basically this trade chip is to do that with Miller and Moore. So that's something I would just be calling on aggressively. And I do think a guy like Batum would help. I mean, I think if you add Batum, and I loved your guys' idea of Noah, I think if you add those two guys to this team, like that brings value this year, moving into next year. So that would be something that I would be looking to do.
That was going to be my next question. Is we've kind of talked at length off record about this team's need for an alpha or an agitator or an asshole or the type that's really going to chew out his other teammates, hold them accountable, be that vocal, fiery engine. Do you think a trade needs to be made to address that now, even if that person is a stopgap? Or do you think you recognize that as an overall need and you're just continually hunting for that right guy that you know, you're going to have?
I don't think it has to be in the quality that you're talking about, as far as like we're talking about like 95 rated guys on the asshole scale. Like, I think you're asking for too much if you just think one of those guys is going to come in and do it. I think what you need to aim for is the quantity. I think you have to have the number of those professionals outweigh the number of up and coming guy, and it's just too tilted. So like for me, Zion, Ingram, I'm hanging on to Hart, and then Hayes, and obviously Nikhil Alexander Walker. Those are the five guys that are 25 and under that I believe on this roster and I'm going to develop. So now, you know, Kendrick, I already kind of see as a veteran in a young kid's body, so I know his age. But what I want is I want 7, 8, 9 guys who are more on the Redick Favors timeline and scale, because there's more coming. Like you said, Didi's coming, and then there's going to be another high first round pick next year, and potentially 2 high seconds that I would imagine we would package those and go get another late first round pick. Like, there's more young guys coming, so you have to start clearing out the Frank Jacksons and the Lonzos and the Jaws, not because there's anything wrong with them, but I need more guys on the 28 and over range than the 27 and under. And I am going to pluck Kendrick and put him in the 28 and up class, even though he's not there age-wise. But I need more guys on that side than on the young, developing, need to teach them how to play basketball side.
So here's a question for you, and it's probably too early to ask, but why not? I think in the future, the Pelicans are going to need to couple some of their draft picks to either A, trade for a star or pseudo-star type player that's going to be in their core, or B, move up in the actual draft to sort of consolidate, one, because they don't have all the resources to develop all these picks that are going to come in the future, but two, just finding the guy that they really like. So kind of like what Dallas did with Doncic, what Philly had tried to do with Markel, that kind of thing. Do you see anyone in this draft that you're eyeing? You're like, man, if the Pelicans have an opportunity to move up for this person, I would do it.
Anthony Edwards is the only one. Like, to me, it's a one-person draft with – and when we say that, that doesn't mean one person's going to be good out of this draft. There's going to be many good players out of this draft. But, he's the only one that it's like, okay, I'll take a swing on another 19-year-old and be patient and wait, and I think I'm going to get a star out of it. I don't really see it with anybody else. Like the LaMelo Ball thing is beyond confusing to me. And then if I had to look at other tiers, like I know he's not shooting well, but I wouldn't mind getting Cole Anthony. But if the opportunity comes next year in the draft and they're like, okay, you got to give us picks and future Laker picks or whatever, the only guy that I would consider as Anthony Edwards.
So follow-up question to that that I started thinking about. It's not necessarily related to the players in this draft class, but has your perspective on the draft capital that the Pelicans got from the Lakers changed over the last month and a half because of the way the Lakers have started?
Not really, because I still think all you really are betting on is – that one season. Like, to me, if one of those picks becomes a top tier pick, I think it's a good haul, especially with what Griffin got for the fourth pick. But I see, when I heard people saying that the Lakers were going to coast through the beginning of the first year and set themselves up for the playoffs, I could not disagree more with that. Like, to me, I didn't expect it to go this good, but I would have bet that the first year, and specifically the first half of the first year, was going to be the best that we were ever going to see from this duo, and I still believe that. I think that they're out to prove something right now that they won't have next year. I think LeBron will obviously be a year older next year, et cetera. So really all I'm betting on is somewhere in the 2022, 2023, 2024, one of those years that injuries happen or LeBron finally shows his age or they make the wrong moves or whatever. But what I don't like is the quantity of capital along with all of the young guys that we have, which is why I would try to redistribute my young guys into veterans. And then by the time I get the young guys that come from those Laker picks, my, Zion and Ingram are playing like veterans and acting like veterans.
I forgot where you put this in your article. Did you have Josh Hart in your will listen to offers but not seek out offers for?
In my others, I believe I put him that I just don't think that his value will, what I'll hear in offers will be worth listening to, and that I do believe he brings a little bit of that veteran presence that I like on a smaller scale from Kendrick, but I would probably hold on to him because if I get a late first, I don't want a late first. And then I don't believe I'm going to get like way out future unprotected or lightly protected first for Josh Hart. So like, if he's a throw in a trade, fine, whatever. But I don't think that he's going to have the value elsewhere that really is going to make moving him make any sense. The two guys I'd be interested in you hearing, like, to me, I think you got to make a trade to make the coach's decisions easier. And I, the other guys I'm passionate about trading, I think, are Frank Jackson and Ja, just to get Gentry out of his own way. And I think Mason will agree with this after seeing what he was saying about Okafor and not understanding last night's game specifically. Like, I think you have to take those options away from Gentry. So the next time Nickeil Alexander-Walker is having a tough stretch, you don't put Frank in those minutes. And the next time the center on the other team is 280 pounds, you don't play Ja just because he's bigger than Hayes. Yeah. Like, to me, I think those are trades you have to make almost regardless of what you get, just to get Gentry out of his own way.
Yeah, and like, I got it when you're putting a guy like Ja in against Andre Drummond, but especially when Favors is starting, I'm not scared about bringing Jax off the bench against anyone's second unit center, and so I don't understand the utility of Okafor at this point. And I agree with Frank too. I mean, I totally understood. And I think Schmidt and I talked about this in an earlier podcast, where you have less runway to figure out what you have with Frank Jackson than you do with a guy like Knott. But at this point, I think we can pretty confidently say what we have in Frank Jackson. So move on from him, move on from Okafor, let Gentry, freely play those guys. And like you said, get out of his own way. But I'm very much in agreement with both of those players.
And if I'm not mistaken, I don't think Ja's contract has been fully guaranteed for the year yet. I think they picked up his option, but it's still non-guaranteed until whatever the league-wide guarantee date is in January. I think that obviously comes before the trade deadline, but I am not against just simply waiving him. It's a minimal cap hit. Obviously, you want something in return, but at this point, who is going to give you something in return?
Yeah, and you've got the Darius Miller disabled player exception you can use to fill that spot. If it's not DD, I mean, you still have that money to play with.
Right. I really like the idea of bringing in Noah. I don't know how his exit from Memphis was in terms of health, like where he is from a health standpoint, but he looked like if you gave him all the minutes that you were giving Ja, there wouldn't be a drop off for the Pelicans. It might even be an increase in terms of what he brings defensively and what he brings from like a playmaking mentality. And he really knows his role and can play it well. And then the effect he might have on others just because he's a loud vocal presence may actually improve things.
Yeah. I think the one tough part with the roster movement is like, unfortunately the Pelicans have 15 really nice, good guys on this roster where I do think it would be beneficial to make a move now where, basically an art of war move where you just chop off someone's head to get everybody else in line. But nobody's really been acting up and nobody's even really been complaining about their role on the roster to the media or their minutes or whatever. Like, I almost wish somebody would step out of line just so Griffin could make an example. But Ja, you just cut him. Like, he's done pretty much all the right things. He's gotten in shape, he's tried hard, he's been in the rotation and then pulled out, not really made any complaints. Like, that's the only thing, if I could wish for something, is I wish one of these guys would, that we already want to trade, would kind of step out of pocket or step out of line so Griffin could make an example and throw that on top of the reasoning for why, we moved on, other than the fact that they just suck. Like, is there a chance?
Yeah, it sends the wrong message to people where like you said, Ja did all the right things. And if doing all the right things gets you this, then
yeah,
what are we really doing here? No, I get it. I get it. I do want to end the podcast with one question. So the final question, and this is something I got heat for, on Twitter, is my taste in chicken, even though I'm a vegetarian. Have you tried the Popeye's chicken sandwich? What's your opinion? And what do you think is a good chicken spot in New Orleans or elsewhere that you'd be like, man, this is something that people need to try, and what makes it so?
Okay, so Popeye's chicken sandwich, really good. I think that it's going after a very low bar. Like, to me, I am in the restaurant business, and the most confusing things to me are, one, how is Papa Murphy's a success? Like, that blows my mind. If somebody would have brought me that idea before it came out, I would have laughed in their face, and I don't get how that business model works. But number two is, I can't understand Chick-fil-A for the life of me. Like, I don't get it at all, how insanely successful that chicken spot is for, like, just very ordinary. And I was talking to this with some other people the other day. I really think the reason Chick-fil-A works is because you are guaranteed a not bad experience. Like, you are not going to go to Chick-fil-A and get something terrible. So I think that there's a safety and a comfort in knowing that, no, my taste buds aren't going to be exploding, but I am going to get an adequate meal for an adequate price and good customer service. But nobody could put that chicken sandwich in my mouth and tell me that it's delicious. So Popeye's absolutely destroys it. Raising Cane's, I know they're just strips, but flavor-wise destroys it. I was a huge Bojangles person growing up, destroys Chick-fil-A. But there's another one coming up. It's in the South. There's none in Louisiana, but I know a lot of your listeners are around in other places. It started in Arkansas, and it's called Slim Chickens. And I'm telling you, you guys got to check this place out. It is absolutely bomb chicken.
I'm very much in agreement across the board there. And especially Bojangles. It's a chain that I didn't really get to experience much growing up, but having traveled around, you know, the Atlanta, Charlotte areas for work a decent amount. I'm pretty sure it's in Atlanta, but specifically Charlotte. I think that's where it started, but it's good. And I agree as well about Chick-fil-A. I've never really understood the hype. And I think average is, when it comes to fast food, average is good. And so the safety net is a pretty decent argument in my mind.
But I don't consider them fast food, because you're not getting like $2 for $1 type value meals. Like, you're paying what you pay at a higher quality plate. Like, if the Chick-fil-A nuggets were 99 cents like at Wendy's, then yeah, like, I give them a thumbs up. But you are paying fast casual prices. You're not paying fast food prices at Chick-fil-A. So that's my apprehension.
My ranking is that the Gardein fake chicken, what do you call it, pseudo chicken, I don't even know what the proper term is, imitation chicken, mm-hmm. Wings are delicious if you want to try some alternative stuff. And the Morningstar ones aren't bad either, but the Gardein ones, pretty solid. Trader Joe's used to have some Trader Joe's brand stuff. I'm pretty sure I've lost like most of the audience by now, but yeah, that is my two cents on this great chicken debate.
Okay, well, we'll declare a winner officially, but awesome job, guys. Thanks. We didn't give away the full article. I have some thoughts on Drew and JJ on the article. So, yeah, if you guys want to check it out on Bourbon Street Shots. And we'll never be on Twitter again, but if you guys want to blast on the site, I might reply to your comments. So,
famous last words.
If you want to get in touch with Mac, just scream at us. And
great.
We won't convey the message. Thanks for listening, folks.